Morning. Last week, I was gone. I was up in a congregation in Brookfield. And after services, I sent Emily a text message because I was curious, because I knew I wasn't going to be the only one gone. And I asked, hey, how many were there? And what was the answer?
36.
36. Is that right, Amy? 36. We were pretty small in number last week. We've increased by something like 50%. There's like 52 of us here this morning. Have you ever asked yourself, I wish our congregation was bigger? Have you ever asked yourself that question? You ever wish, well, I wish it wasn't 36 or 52. I wish it was 136 or 152. I've thought that. And I think it's normal. I think it's normal if you've thought, I wish our congregation was a little bit larger. But being small isn't a problem. There's a country song not so long ago by Alan Jackson. Right? It says, it's all right to be little bitty. This morning we're going to talk about being a small congregation. But I think we should want our congregation to continuously grow. But growth isn't necessarily always in numbers, but certainly if our congregation could go from 36 to 52 to 80, something like that, or even larger, that would be great. Congregations come in all sizes, don't they? I did a quick search this morning, and I don't know if it's accurate or not, but as the religious world counts churches. The Churches of Christ are the 22nd largest group. Now, there's a lot of other groups thrown in there, so I don't know that we would necessarily group ourselves with them, but as this one particular website grouped us, we were in a group that was the 22nd largest religious group, and yet we have the fourth highest number of congregations. Well, start doing some deduction and you can figure out pretty quick what that means. What that means is that Churches of Christ, by and large, are relatively small. Congregations come in all sizes. If you were to look across the religious spectrum, the average attendance at any one congregation or one group of people is about 186. Could you imagine a Church of Christ that was 186? I don't know of any group that's 186 that we associate with. Even this one website said that the average number of average membership at Churches of Christ was 92. I had a hard time coming up with even five congregations that I knew had memberships that were 92. The point is that we are not a large congregation. There certainly are large Churches of Christ, but large is a relative term, right? In 2010, 50% of churchgoers attend a group that is 350 people or more. You think, wow, that is tremendous. And yet, if you were part of those groups, you might think large is a congregation of 1,000 or more. So large is relative, of course. But I don't know of anyone who would say that our congregation is large. I think if you were to describe our congregation to your friends or people that you work with, if you're like me, you describe it as, we're a pretty small group. That's generally how I describe our congregation, that we are we're a fairly small group. Each size of congregation certainly has its advantages, don't they? Larger congregations tend to have more resources. They certainly appear to be more active. That may or may not be accurate. Larger congregations are more likely to have someone who has very similar non-religious interests than you. You know, we've got, if you're a Cardinals fan, just as an example, there's a lot of other Cardinals fans here. There's Eddie. Eddie and I were Royals fans. I don't know, Logan, are you a Royals fan? Okay, well, there you go. Now there's like three of us. But you know, if you're a hockey fan, you're going to probably be the only one here, right? If you stay up and watch soccer, well, I don't know why you're here. Okay, never mind. The point is that in a larger congregation, there's going to be people who share the interest that you have. We have a lot of people in this congregation who are hunters. That's why there were many of us gone last week. But that's really just maybe one example of something where in a smaller congregation, there are people who share same interests, but there's interests that I have that maybe there's no one else in the congregation. Smaller congregations, of course, have some benefits that are often lost in larger congregations. So this morning, we're going to talk about the purpose, really, of this lesson is not to encourage us to remain small, so to speak, but to remind us that there are great benefits that we have here because we are a smaller group, and we have obligations as a smaller congregation. And ultimately, I think we're going to see that what God intended is for churches to remain small. And the reason I say that is that God once had what the world would call a mega church, right? You think about the day of Pentecost, that there were, 120 people that were in an upper room when the Holy Spirit lighted on the apostles. And then from that and their teaching, what happened? 3,000 souls were added. And we know that there were likely more that were added after that. The congregation at Jerusalem was thousands. It was, by any definition, a mega church. And yet, what happened? That was not God's plan, was it? God's plan was not that the church stay in one location. I think that's probably more of the issue than the size, but certainly God didn't want the congregation to be that large, because we look at large groups through the Bible and what happens. Think about Babylon, right? The people all had one mind, and what did they do? They started trying to make a name for themselves. So there was a time when God had one mega church, and God, through persecution of the Romans, spread the congregations across the known world. So let's start and talk just for a little while about the benefits of smaller churches. The first and most obvious benefit of a small congregation is an extremely strong sense of family. And some of that is because of our physical family ties. You know, we have some pretty large family groups, but there certainly are some among us who aren't physically related. But that's not the kind of family I'm talking about. I'm talking about our spiritual family. Because Jesus intended for the church to be a family. Think about what Jesus says in Mark chapter 3. So Jesus is teaching, and if you remember in this situation, his mother and his brothers come to get him. Now, at this point in time, his brothers, which we later see were part of that 120 that were in the upper room in Acts chapter 1, but they didn't believe Jesus at this time. Mark chapter 3, I'll just read verses 31 through 34. Then his brothers and his mother came, and standing outside, they sent him, calling him. And a multitude was sitting around him, and they said to him, "Look, your mother and your brothers are outside seeking you." But he answered them and said, "Who is my mother or my brothers?" And he looked around in a circle at those who sat about him and said, "Here are my mother and my brothers. For whoever does the will of God is my brother and my sister and my mother." Jesus here was sort of telling us lots of things. One is that in the grand scheme of things, our spiritual family ought to be more important than our physical family. But he's also telling us that we do have a spiritual family. The church is, as God intended it to be, a family. Remember in Galatians chapter 4, talking about the church, Paul writes and says, "But Jerusalem above is free, which is what? The mother of us all." The church very much is our mother, is our upbringing. And so we are part of a family because God intends the church to be a family. And we are the family of God and a family with all other Christians. Now, there certainly are some among us who have our physical family here. I've certainly been blessed with that. Paige and Reese, both sides of their family are members of the church. But there's also those among us who don't enjoy that, who the only spiritual family that they have are people who are not part of their physical family. In other words, their physical family is not part of their spiritual family. But we are a family of God and a family to other Christians. In Mark chapter 10, verse 28 through 30, then Peter began to say to him, "See, we have left all and followed you." So Jesus answered and said, "Assuredly, I say to you, there is no one who has left house or brother or sister or father or mother or wife or children or lands for my sake and the gospel's, who shall not receive 100-fold now in this time houses and brothers and sisters and mothers and children and lands with persecution and in the age to come eternal life." Jesus makes it very clear that there will be people amongst the church who had to walk away from their physical family. And the only family they have left is their spiritual family. Psalm 68, 5 and 6, the psalmist writes, "A father of the fatherless, a defender of widows, is God in his holy habitation. God sets the solitary in families. He brings out those who are abound in prosperity, but the rebellious dwell in a dry land." See, God puts the solitary in family. If you don't have any other family, if you're an orphan and you become part of the church, you have a family. Because all of us have a family here in the church. And Paul instructs us to treat our fellow Christians like our family, doesn't he? In 1 Timothy chapter 5, Paul writes to Timothy and says, "Do not rebuke an older man, but exhort him as a father, younger men as brothers, older women as mothers, younger as sisters, with all purity." See, not only are we part of a family, we're supposed to treat each other like a family. And Paul makes that very clear. To Timothy, he says, don't rebuke an older man. Instead, treat him like you would treat your father. And likewise, he goes on through other relationships. We're supposed to treat our fellow Christians like they're our family. And so in smaller congregations, we are more apt to function and feel like a family. You see, you know everyone, right? I look around and I know everybody in the room. And even if everyone was here, I would still know everyone in the room. Now, I think that, I should say this, I thought that I had a fairly large family. When we would have family get-togethers, I mean, the house was packed. And I say I thought I had a fairly large family because we have a fairly large family that's missing from us this morning. You know, there's obviously some families larger than my family. The Welties are a good example of that. But you know what? There's families larger than the Welties too. We all know of people who have very large families. But do you know anyone who has a family so large that they don't even know the names of their brothers and sisters? Do you know anybody whose family is that large? Can you think of anyone who has a family so large that they don't even know the names of their brothers and sisters? Oh, I think I heard a whisper out there, and that was Solomon, right? You ever wondered how many children, was it Dwayne, was that you? Okay. You ever wondered how many children Solomon had? I mean, we don't know, we're not told. We know how many wives and concubines he had, right? He had like 1,000. So there's this interesting situation. There's this guy by the name of Mullah Ismail Sharif. He was a Moroccan emperor, and he was said to have a harem of 500 women, so half the number of Solomon. So Solomon, we know, between his wives and concubines, had 1,000. This man, this Moroccan emperor, he had 500 wives, and he is said to have sired 888 children. So, if Solomon if Solomon had twice as many wives, then maybe Solomon has twice as many children, something like 1,800 children. I don't know. All right, so if you're in that situation, then you're not going to know the names of your brothers and sisters. But none of us are in that situation. And so we know the names of our brothers and sisters. But it's even more than that, isn't it, right? So when you're in a smaller congregation, you not only know their names, but you know about them. You know that Eddie's a Royals fan, right? You probably know that because his hat sits on the back. But you know other details, too, about each other, right? You know what jobs people have. You know what kinds of food they like. You know what hobbies they have. In some ways, you know what makes people tick, right? You know how to make someone happy, how to encourage someone. You probably know how to frustrate each other, too. And so, in a smaller congregation, it does truly function like a family. And you also know when people are missing. You know, something like 10 years ago, Dwayne gave a table talk about that this is like a family dinner. And I don't know, it just stuck with me. And it really is like a family dinner. Could you imagine having dinner with your family and one of your children not being there and you just not even paid attention to it? You just didn't even notice, right? What happens? You look around. You wait. Sometimes you wait longer on certain people than you do others, right? But you wait. And so our congregation, too, because we are a smaller congregation, we know who are missing. And I can't think of the number of times that Bob and Dwayne have got up to give announcements, and while standing here, they recognize that someone is missing and say, does anybody know about so-and-so? And if the answer is no one knows, you know, it isn't that uncommon that we come back in the evening and someone has called that person and gives an announcement as to why they are missing. So look around. Do you see who's missing this morning? Do you know why they're missing? Is there something that's happening in their life that you should be praying for them? Should you call them? Should you go see them? In Galatians chapter 6, verses 1 through 2, brethren, if a man is overtaken in any trespass, you who are spiritual, restore such a one in a spirit of gentleness, considering yourself, lest you also be tempted. Bear one another's burdens, and so fulfill the law of Christ. See, our group, our congregation, we have the advantage of knowing each other and knowing when someone is missing, which is often the first sign that there's something going wrong. You also know when someone is hurting. You know when somebody's happy. In 1 Corinthians chapter 12, sort of midway through the discussion about the body being made of many members, in verses 25 and 27 through 27, Paul says this: there should be no schism in the body, that the members should have the same care for one another. And if one member suffers, all the members suffer with it. And if one member is honored, all the members rejoice with it. Now you are the body of Christ and members individually. How many times have we had some kind of announcement that is a positive announcement and we rejoice with the people who that announcement is about? How many times have there been a negative announcement? I mean, it doesn't even have to be an announcement. It could just be, we know that this particular brother, this particular sister is hurting, and so we bear one another's burdens. There's also this interesting dynamic of building across generations, developing relationships across generations. Think about this for a minute. How many people of another generation outside of your family and outside of the church do you actually spend time with? I mean, I work with people of different generations, but do I actually spend time with them? How many people outside of your own generation, outside of your own family, outside of your own church, do you actually have concern for? You know, we are commanded to work across generational lines. Older men and older women are commanded to teach the younger in Titus chapter 2. Younger Christians, likewise, in that same chapter, are commanded to learn from and listen to the wisdom of the elders. And so we have this cross-generational relationships that are developed in smaller congregations. In larger congregations, what happens? Well, you've got your teen group, you've got your young family group, you've got your empty nesters, you've got your all these little subgroups, and so there isn't that same kind of relationships across generations. We often also have similar challenges to a family. I get the pleasure of hiring everybody in my department, and I describe my department to new employees as a family. We do function like a family. We are a very close-knit group. I have some of my team that, well, they don't have a spiritual family, and so their work family is the substitute. I think we see that a lot in the world today, but they do things outside of work together. And so I always tell every new employee that our department is like a big family. And I'm not going to tell you all the details, but you're going to find people in the department who you really like and you get along with. And there's going to be people in the department who you kind of are like oil and water. And you know what? My expectation is that you work together, right? In a family, you work it out. Even when you have personalities that don't blend very well. And so we, as a congregation, often have similar challenges to a family in that we don't always get along. This is easily remedied in larger congregations, right? You just don't even sit with those people. But, you know, that doesn't work that way in a smaller congregation. You got to work things out, just like a family. So the first thing that a smaller congregation has that's a benefit is that we function like a family. The second benefit of being in a smaller congregation is that we as individuals have a greater opportunity to grow. There's a greater need for every person to get involved. There's more roles for each of us to do, and of course, it's more noticeable when there are those that aren't participating. In larger congregation, a person can sometimes get lost and never use their talents. I know of one congregation that has so many speakers and teachers that each individual man that participates as a speaker or teacher, they may only speak two or three times a year, and they may only teach class once every few years. And I know some of you are thinking, man, that sounds pretty good, right? I know others are thinking, James chapter 3, verse 1 says, let not there be many teachers, right? The point here is that it's difficult for us to become better teachers, better preachers, better song leaders, better whatever, if we rarely have the opportunity. You know, I work in a small community hospital, and there are things that we don't do in my departments, and the specific reason, it's not because we're not capable of doing it. It's the very specific reason as to why we don't do that is we would do it so infrequently, we would put patients at risk. We would probably not be very good at it. And so there is something to say about having a large enough group that there isn't a burden on single individuals, but not so large that you don't get to hone your skills and participate as frequently as you would need. It's just like conditioning your body, right? If I wanted to be able to go out and run a 5K, well, my body is in such good shape, I could just go do it right now. And then you'd have my funeral next week. Right? You just don't go do those things, right? You condition yourselves. You build up to it, right? Just like any physical activity, whether it's running a 5K or weightlifting or throwing a baseball. I can remember I hadn't thrown a baseball for a really long time, and I got asked to go play softball. And I mean, I started throwing that ball, and oh my goodness, my shoulder. That's what would happen if I got asked to go play softball right now. But one of the challenges of a smaller congregation is the potential to rely on a single individual or a small group of people to do most, if not all, of the work. And we could be tempted to look at those small group of people instead of looking at Christ. In 3 John chapter 1, verses 9 and 10, I think we see something like that. You know, Bob has been teaching about preeminence in Colossians, about how Christ is supposed to have the preeminence. But do you remember that in 3 John, it's this book about two men, Gaius and Diotrephes. And so this part we'll read about is Diotrephes, where John says, "I wrote to the church, but Diotrephes, who loves to have the preeminence among them, does not receive us. Therefore, if I come, I will call to mind his deeds which he does, prating against us with malicious words. Not content with that, he himself does not receive the brethren and forbids those who wish to, putting them out of the church." See, Diotrephes had a problem. Diotrephes' problem was he loved the preeminence. He wanted to be more important than what he was. And one of the challenges, one of the things that smaller congregations have to look out for is creating Diotrephes, creating men who do most or all of the work, and as a result, they become more important to other people and to themselves than what they really should be. Again, we are all Christians. We're following after Christ. But in a smaller congregation, you're also more likely to step up and try something new. Oftentimes, if you didn't act, then maybe no one would have acted. There would have been no one to do it. And it could be simple things like when visitors come. Do you greet them or do you expect someone else to do it? If a brother or sister is in need, do you step forward to help? In smaller congregations, there's more opportunity for you to get outside of your comfort zone. Think of the numerous times in the Bible that we have people, examples of people who stepped up, right? Phinehas in Numbers chapter 25, he stopped a plague that killed 24,000 Israelites. Nehemiah, he was the cupbearer, and it was because of his one action. He spoke up that resulted in him becoming governor and the walls of Jerusalem being rebuilt. We could think of other examples, but these were people who took the opportunity that was given them. And there's greater opportunity in smaller congregation. You need to have in a smaller congregation the attitude of Elisha. In Elisha chapter 6 verse 8, we read, "I also heard the voice of the Lord saying, 'Whom shall I send and who will go for us?' Then I said, 'Here am I, send me.'" That's the attitude that you need to have. But collectively, we can accomplish great things for God. Remember in Romans chapter 8, verse 13, "What shall we say then to these things? If God is for us, who can be against us?" Throughout the Bible, God accomplishes great things through small groups of people. You remember Gideon? Remember the story of Gideon? Gideon had an extremely large army. He was going to go fight against the Midianite army. You know, we know the number that the Midianites had. They had 135,000 men. And so Gideon's going to go after and fight after them. But God wanted to make a point to Gideon and to us that God is the one at work, not us. And so through the course of a number of tests and actions, Gideon gets an army, if you even called it that, of 300 men to go up against 135,000 men. What's the point there? The point is, it's God who's doing the work through whatever number he has to work with. Think about Jonathan and his armor bearer in 1 Samuel chapter 14. You remember that story? Jonathan and his armor bearer, they're sort of looking out at this encampment, an entire garrison of the Philistines. And Jonathan, I mean, could you just imagine this conversation? Jonathan looks to his sword bearer, "Hey, let's go get him." "What? What's wrong with you?" "Oh, listen, let's go get him and let's look for a sign." And they get the sign. And what happens? Jonathan and his armor bearer, they win. Think about what God did with 12 apostles who turned the world upside down and ushered in the perfect law of liberty. Jonah converted 120,000 people. I mean, we could look at dozens of examples of this. God doesn't care about the size of the congregation. He cares about the people who are willing to do His work. It's also much easier for us to watch for spiritual stagnation, you know, and watch out for the weak too. Like, we can watch out for each other, whether it's because we're stagnating, whether it's because we're weak. 1 Thessalonians chapter 5, verse 14, "We exhort you, brethren, warn those who are unruly, comfort the faint-hearted, uphold the weak, be patient with all." You can do those things, right? You can give focus to those things. We can warn the unruly. You're going to know if somebody in the smaller congregation is unruly, right? You're going to be able to comfort the faint-hearted because you'll know who they are. You'll be able to uphold the weak. It also applies to a congregation as a whole. In bigger congregation, it may be more difficult for us to see who's active or who is not. But in a smaller church, it's easy to tell if we as a whole are being active and trying to grow in God's kingdom, or if we're just sitting around waiting for someone else and doing nothing. We know that many large congregations sometimes struggle with this. They have this perception of activity and production, but really, there's a lot of folks who just aren't being productive or active. Those things are easily spotted out in a smaller congregation. Of course, smaller congregations are more likely to have obvious problems with spiritual stagnation and discouragement. We can become like the 10 spies in Numbers chapter 13, who forget that God is on their side. Remember, Moses sent 12 spies, and 10 of them are like, oh man, it's too much. But we want to be like those two. We want to be like Joshua and Caleb, and know that God is on our side. And so, when you look around and you think, man, there were 36 people here last Sunday, or there's only 52 here, think about what God did with numbers much fewer than that. Being part of a smaller congregation certainly has its benefits, has a stronger sense of family, it has an opportunity for us to step up and do more. You know, think about our Wednesday evening services. We have, you know, four young guys that are leading songs that if they were in a larger congregation, they probably would never have had that opportunity. We have this last year been splitting up some of our Sunday evening lessons to give folks opportunities. There's plenty of opportunities to teach. There's opportunities to go and visit the elderly and shut in, things that you might not have had an opportunity if you were in a larger group. That's the lesson I have for you this morning. It doesn't really lend itself to an invitation except to say that the church is a family. And there is always room in this family for you. And unlike your physical family, which you had no choice in, right? You didn't have a choice who your parents are. Sometimes that's a good thing, sometimes that's a bad thing. You don't get to choose your parents. You really don't get to choose your children either. I mean, you can choose to have children. You certainly can choose to have a family in that regard, but you're part of a physical family whether you chose to be or not. But you can choose to be part of God's family. And that choice is available to you now as it is at any time. There's room in the family if you want to be part of it. So consider your soul as we stand and sing.